Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. There has been a dramatic increase in the number of civilian casualties due to cluster munitions in the last year. New data from the UN-partnered Cluster Munition Monitor Civil Society Group indicates 1,172 people were killed or injured in 2022, which is the highest number since regular reporting started in 2010. 95% were civilians. Most of the casualties were caused by cluster munition attacks in Ukraine. The report's authors say that the vast majority were carried out by Russian forces, although Ukrainian forces have also deployed them, causing civilian harm. Cluster munitions are weapons that are fired from the ground by artillery or dropped by aircraft. They open in the air to disperse hundreds of mini-bombs over a wide area. Many fail to explode on initial impact, leaving a lethal legacy. In 2022, over 70% of casualties from remnants were children. The report's authors insisted that governments must unite to firmly condemn their use and join the global ban on these weapons, the Convention on Cluster Munitions. A total of 112 countries have ratified or acceded to the 2008 treaty so far, while 12 have signed it. $125 million in humanitarian funding has been released from the UN's Emergency Response Fund to boost underfunded aid operations in 14 countries in Africa, Asia, the Americas, and the Middle East. The development comes as the UN Humanitarian Affairs Coordination Office, OCHA, warned that the humanitarian plans for these countries were all under 36% funded. Afghanistan and Yemen, which OCHA described as among the world's most protracted and neglected crises, topped the recipient list with $20 million each. UN Emergency Relief Coordinator Martin Griffiths stressed that the use of the funding to fill some of the gaps saved lives, and he deplored the cruel reality of funding shortages experienced by aid agencies right at a time when people's needs compel them to scale up. OCHA noted that in 2023, global funding requirements have surpassed $55 billion to support 250 million people affected by conflict, the impact of the climate crisis, natural disasters, disease outbreaks, displacement, and other crises. An unprecedented number of migrants and refugees continue to cross the dense tropical jungle between Colombia and Panama, known as the Darien Gap, risking their lives and facing horrific human rights abuses, the UN Rights Office, OHCHR, said on Tuesday. So far this year, more than 330,000 people have crossed the Darien Gap on their journey to North America, the highest annual figure recorded to date, OHCHR said. One in five were children. With more, here's OHCHR spokesperson Marta Hurtado.
Migrants and refugees are exposed to multiple human rights violations and abuses during their journey, including sexual violence, which is a particular risk for children, women, LGBTI people, and people with disabilities. There are also murders, disappearances, trafficking, robbery, and intimidation by organized crime groups.
OHCHR said that with international support, the government of Panama has built three migration centers to provide shelter, food, healthcare, and water and sanitation for the people on the move, but capacity remains stretched. The UN office called on the international community to help close protection gaps and address the structural factors forcing people to leave their homes. Dominika Tomaszewska-Mortimer, UN News.
At Hoover's September 30, 1935 dedication, Interior Secretary Harold Ickes declared, "Pridefully, man acclaims his conquest of nature." Hoover's image became one of the nation's most popular exports. Between Hoover and the end of the century, more than 45,000 large dams were built in 140 countries.
On the next broadcast of TUC Radio.
That's coming up in the second hour.
Blog Talk Radio.
Radio Free Kansas.
Kansas.
Let's talk about
Radio Free Kansas out of North Jefferson County, Kansas.
Common side effects include heart failure, persistent fever, bruising, bleeding, lymphoma, nervous system, and blood disorders.
The message is now part of and registered in your subconscious mind. Every time you say, see, hear, or think.
Radio Free Kansas.
That's your key phrase. It will trigger the entire message without your being aware of it.
Oh, man, that is just wrong.
If you wish to survive, you need to cultivate a strong mental attitude.
It's a fool who looks for logic in the chambers of the human heart.
Coming to you live.
Well, I'm telling you, we will be breaking 5,000 episodes. 5,000 episodes in the history of Radio Free Kansas. This week, we'll be breaking it. So that we should have an online party of some sort, huh? What do you think? Coming up is the latest headlines from Democracy Now, reported this morning. But first, let's celebrate. Let's just celebrate, goddammit.
This is a movement. We're going to make our country great again. Believe me, we will make our country great again.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Enrique Tarrio, the former leader of the far-right Proud Boys, has been sentenced to 22 years in prison, the longest sentence handed down to anyone involved in the January 6th insurrection. In May, Tarrio and three other members of the Proud Boys were convicted of seditious conspiracy. On Tuesday, U.S. District Judge Timothy Kelly said Tarrio was, quote, the ultimate leader of that conspiracy. Tarrio received the stiffest sentence, even though he was not in Washington on the day of January 6th, since he'd been arrested in a separate case days earlier and was ordered to stay away from D.C. During the trial, prosecutors had portrayed the Proud Boys as having served as Donald Trump's army on January 6th. Last week, four other Proud Boys were sentenced to between 10 and 18 years in prison. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has arrived in Kyiv on an unannounced visit to Ukraine. This is Blinken's fourth trip to Ukraine since the Russian invasion, but for the first time, Blinken plans to spend the night. He's expected to announce a new package worth more than $1 billion in U.S. aid for Ukraine.
We want to make sure that Ukraine has what it needs not only to succeed in the counteroffensive, but has what it needs for the long term to make sure that it has a strong deterrent, strong defense capacity, so that in the future, aggressions like this don't happen again.
Blinken's visit came just hours after Russian cruise missiles hit Kyiv in the first aerial attack on the capital in about a week. Meanwhile, a Russian drone hit the Danube port of Izmail in the Odessa region, killing one person. There are a number of developments in the legal cases against Donald Trump. Former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows pleaded not guilty Tuesday and waived his formal arraignment. Meadows is one of Trump's 18 co-defendants accused of being part of a criminal enterprise that attempted to overturn the 2020 election in Georgia. Attorney John Eastman and former Justice Department official Jeffrey Clark also pleaded not guilty Tuesday. Meanwhile, in Washington, D.C., special counsel Jack Smith has warned Trump's daily statements may prejudice the jury pool in Washington, where Trump is facing a separate criminal trial. Trump has repeatedly attacked Smith, as well as U.S. District Judge Tanya Chutkan. In other legal news, the trial of Trump's former trade advisor, Peter Navarro, has begun. He was indicted for refusing to comply with a subpoena from the House committee investigating the January 6th insurrection. In Atlanta, Georgia, 61 activists have been indicted on RICO charges for their involvement in the protests against a construction of a massive $90 million police training complex known as Cop City. Georgia's Republican Attorney General Christopher Carr accuses the activists of violating the state's Racketeer Influence and Corrupt Organizations Act. The indictment was handed up by the same Fulton County grand jury panel that indicted President Donald Trump and 18 co-defendants on RICO charges. Many of the protests have already been charged with domestic terrorism. The ACLU blasted the indictment of the Cop City protesters. ACLU attorney Amra Ahmad said, quote, "We are extremely concerned by this breathtakingly broad and unprecedented use of state terrorism, anti-racketeering, and money laundering laws against protesters," unquote. We'll have more on this story after headlines. The United Nations Secretary General announced earlier today that climate breakdown has begun. Antonio Guterres made the remark at the World Meteorological Organization released new data on this summer's record-breaking heat in the Northern Hemisphere. According to the organization, last month was the hottest August on record, quote, by a large margin, and the second hottest month ever recorded. The only month hotter was this past July. Guterres said, quote, "The dog days of summer are not just barking, they are biting." This comes as extreme weather continues to devastate areas across the globe. In southern Brazil, at least 21 people have died after a cyclone triggered floods and landslides in the state of Rio Grande do Sul. The storm forced at least 6,000 people from their homes.
"I feel devastated. I lost everything. There are many people who lost much more, but here at home I have nothing left."
In other climate news, a massive rainstorm hit Greece, Turkey, Bulgaria, killing at least 7 people. In Istanbul, about a dozen people had to be rescued from a library after being stranded by floods. Parts of Greece recorded more than 30 inches of rain. The storm comes as Greece just begins to recover from record-breaking wildfires. Meanwhile, in China, a typhoon inundated the southeastern province of Fujian, forcing tens of thousands to flee their homes. India is preparing to host the G20's annual summit for the first time. The talks begin in Delhi Saturday. For months, Indian authorities have ordered bulldozers to destroy the homes of people who live in shanties near the G20 conference. Many displaced residents say they have no place to go.
"We have been living here for the last 25 to 30 years. Where do we go now that our houses are suddenly demolished? We have no facilities or a place to live, and we have become homeless and are on the road. I hope the authorities get sick and die, and they will be cursed by the poor."
Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva has officially recognized 2 indigenous territories in an attempt to protect the land from illegal loggers, miners, and cattle ranchers. Lula spoke Tuesday at a ceremony to mark Amazon Day.
"The Amazonian people deserve to have their rights guaranteed and opportunities for a better life. If there is no future for the Amazon and its people, there will be no future for the planet either. That is what today's event is about, concrete actions to guarantee the future of the Amazon and each of us."
In a major diplomatic development, Saudi Arabia and Iran have exchanged ambassadors, formally ending a 7-year diplomatic rift between the oil giants. In March, China brokered a deal for the two countries to restore relations. The Spanish Soccer Federation has appointed Montse Tomé to become the first woman to serve as coach of the women's national soccer team, which won the Women's World Cup 3 weeks ago. The announcement was made shortly after the federation fired coach Jorge Vilda, who had long faced criticism for his coaching style. Calls for Vilda's resignation grew after he expressed support for Spanish Soccer Federation President Luis Rubiales, who forcibly kissed Spanish player Jenny Hermoso during the Women's World Cup award ceremony. Rubiales is facing nationwide calls to be ousted, including from the women's soccer team staff and prominent politicians. Spain's Prime Minister, Pedro Sanchez, said, quote, "One cannot aspire to represent Spain and make Spain look bad with attitudes and speeches that embarrass us and that do not represent us," unquote. In the United States, a federal court has struck down Alabama's congressional map, which was designed by Republicans to dilute the power of black voters. The judges said they were, quote, deeply troubled that lawmakers had defied a prior court order to draw a map with two majority black districts. Two of the judges in this case were appointed by Donald Trump. A court-appointed special master will now draw new congressional districts. Alabama's attorney general has vowed to appeal the decision. In Texas, the impeachment trial of Republican Attorney General Ken Paxton has begun in the Republican-controlled Texas State Senate. Paxton has pleaded not guilty to all 16 articles of impeachment. He is accused of abusing his office, bribery, and obstruction of justice. Here in New York, the police department has agreed to change how it responds to protests after reaching a settlement in lawsuits stemming from the department's violent response to the Black Lives Matter protests in 2020. The NYPD reached the settlement with New York Attorney General Letitia James, the Legal Aid Society, and the New York Civil Liberties Union. As part of the settlement, the NYPD agreed to stop using a tactic called kettling to trap and arrest protesters. Other key elements to the settlement include the creation of a new oversight committee to assess how police respond to protests. New York Attorney General Letitia James said, quote, "Too often, peaceful protesters have been met with force that has harmed innocent New Yorkers simply trying to exercise their rights. Today's agreement will meaningfully change how the NYPD engages with and responds to public demonstrations in New York City," she said. And former New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson has died at the age of 75. He also served as U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Energy Secretary, U.S. Congress member, yet spent 14 years in Congress, including a period as chair of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus. Richardson also went on dozens of humanitarian missions to help secure the release of Americans held overseas, including trips to Iraq, Afghanistan, Cuba, Colombia, Sudan, North Korea, and Russia, where he helped free the WNBA star Brittany Griner. As Energy Secretary, Richardson faced criticism for his handling of the arrest of the Taiwanese-American nuclear scientist Wen Ho Lee, who was held for 278 days in solitary confinement after being falsely accused of being a Chinese spy. Wen Ho Lee eventually pled guilty to a minor charge. At the time, a federal judge issued a dramatic apology to Wen Ho Lee, but Richardson would continue to defend his handling of the case. He appeared on Democracy Now! In 2005.
I believe that we acted properly in safeguarding our nuclear secrets. He was convicted on several counts. There were some mistakes in that case. It involved the entire federal government, and I stand behind everything that I did.
To see the whole interview with Governor Richardson that Juan Gonzalez and I did back in 2005 in Santa Fe, go to democracynow.org. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
That's right. You can get Democracy Now! Here in Northeast Kansas by 7 in the morning on channel over the air, channel 19.2, which is the PBS affiliate out of Kansas City. And I believe channel 11, KTWU, out of Topeka, the PBS affiliate, has it 3 or 4 in the afternoon. You'll have to check their schedule. It's been a while since I've checked in myself over there. You should. Support your PBS affiliates. Coming up now, Radio EcoShock, Alex Smith. He has one of the largest in the world archives of environmental radio shows, and almost all of them he broadcasts. And his show is carried on over 105 radio stations. He broadcasts from Border, the town Border in British Columbia, Canada. Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Have we already entered a new climate? Recent extreme heat, rains, violent storms struck around the world. Meteorologist and storm chaser Bob Henson covers extreme weather for you. Meanwhile, big oil and gas pump out even more carbon, guaranteeing climate catastrophe. We should sue them. West Coast environmental lawyer Andrew Gage explains how. Welcome back to a new season of Radio EcoShock. Climate concern was 20 years ago. 10 years ago, scientists worried out loud. Now it's definitely time to panic. Every sign points to a new climate regime here on planet Earth, and we are not going to like it. A new study by Joshua Pierce at the University of Western Ontario finds a billion people could die if global warming reaches 2 degrees C over pre-industrial. That 2 degrees is expected this century by many experts, possibly by 2070 on our current path. Nobody can track all the jaw-dropping extremes popping up around the world, north and south, pole to pole. During the Northern Hemisphere summer, record-smashing heat warped the southern United States and the far north in Canada and Alaska, as you will hear. More northern forests burned this year than ever before, emitting a big burst of carbon into the atmosphere to add more warming. China had its month of too hot to go outside punishment. That heat bedeviled Japan until a few days ago. Excess deaths, which will be counted later, will reflect these times. Europe had a mixed bag of everything but normal. Saharan heat flowed up into Spain, Portugal, Italy, and Greece. On August 23rd, France had the hottest August day on record. Switzerland broke its all-time high, and so did Milan. The largest wildfire ever recorded in the European Union is still burning in Greece as we go to air. But Northern Europe stayed cooler above the heat band, with occasional flash floods and even odd snow in the Alps. North Africa and the Middle East were unhumanly hot for months. I can't tell you the suffering of unprotected people there, with temperatures reaching and exceeding 50 degrees C, over 122, nearing the world record marks. But the heat did not stay in the Northern Hemisphere. Parts of the South got summer heat in winter. We're going to hear more about that. It was over 35 degrees in Bolivia at altitude in winter. At the end of August, Perth, Australia set an absolute record for winter highs, and so did South Africa. We will explore why and what this means a little bit later in the program. First, let's get to a review from a proper weather expert. The summer of 2023 was a nightmare of record heat, wildfires, and floods around the world, but of course, not everywhere. From headline hurricanes to extreme heat, American author and journalist Bob Henson tracks it all. Bob Henson's work pops up everywhere. He produced award-winning news and reports for the National Center for Atmospheric Research. His articles have appeared in Nature, Scientific American, and more. Bob wrote and produced quick weather updates for radio called The Weather Notebook. Over his decades of journalism, Bob sees the science, the stats, and the history of extreme weather unfolding. From Boulder, Colorado, Bob Henson, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hey, Alex, thanks very much for having me. Good to be back on.
Yeah, well, there's a world of wild weather out there, as we all know, but let's stick with the United States and Canada for this. As a well-known storm expert, I bet you were flooded with work as Hurricane Idalia bolted up out of the Gulf. What stands out to you about that storm?
Well, several things. One thing is that it was predicted really well. The forecasts from the U.S. National Hurricane Center were pretty much as spot on as one could possibly hope for. The hurricane fell well within the initial cone issued several days earlier. And other good news is that it came in at a very unpopulated place by Florida standards. So it looks like deaths and serious injuries are very minimal. There was certainly a lot of flooding, as one might expect, with this being a very strong Cat 3 hurricane. And a large area got some flooding, but very little got the kind of catastrophic storm surge we were really worried about. So again, that reduced the impact in terms of injuries and fatalities. Still probably likely to be a multi-billion dollar storm, but, you know, by the standards of recent years, you know, it's probably one of the lower impact major hurricane landfalls of the many we've had in the last 7 or 8 years.
Well, I think part of that is because it moved through so quickly. I mean, hurricanes don't have their own engine, so to speak. They get pushed around by other winds, and this one moved over fairly fast compared to, say, Harvey. When that hit Texas, it just hung around, and in fact, it swung back and struck again 3 days later. So the track is pretty important when it comes to damage.
Absolutely, and at the same time, it also intensified as it was accelerating towards the coast. And the rapid intensification is one of the strongest signals of climate change. We've just seen that happening over and over again, where hurricanes are putting on their biggest surges of strength in the last 24 hours, which of course poses challenges in the forecast as well as in making people aware. You know, you can say, okay, 2 or 3 days from now we're going to have a Cat 3 or 4 landfall, but right now this is a tropical storm. Tomorrow it'll still be a Category 1. That message, which is totally accurate, is just tailor-made for complacency, because you hear that and think, oh, I've got time, you know, and maybe 2 days out you think you've got time, and then you find you don't. So it's the trend toward the rapid intensifiers is very worrisome. And fortunately, this one did its rapid intensification and came on in a relatively unpopulated area. And it wasn't an especially large hurricane, even though it developed from a very, very large initial wind field of circulation. So several things fell into place in a good way, especially because this made landfall during a blue moon, super moon with a very high tidal range. So fortunately, in most places it avoided the worst.
Okay, well, let's get to the heat, because the month and a half of punishing heat in the U.S. South, and including where the hurricane hit, is harder to show on TV news than hurricane damage. But heat kills more Americans than storms every year, and certainly damages crops and living things, and it's very uncomfortable, of course. Are we underestimating that record heat that was just hovering in the U.S. South all during the summer of 2023?
I do think it's easy to underestimate the impact of that, especially if you're not from the South and live there or have not spent much time there. I think in those cases, it's easy for someone to say, oh, well, it's the South. It gets hot all the time. And of course it does, and people are on the whole well adapted to heat there. You know, the vast majority of folks have air conditioning, and if they don't, they typically find places to go if they can, or they find ways to stay cool at home if they absolutely need to. I went a summer as a child without air conditioning in Oklahoma for one summer, and that was pretty intense. But all that said, it has just been a stunning summer of heat, and it's really wrapping up in August. You know, basically a number of cities all along the Gulf Coast states had their hottest month in history in August of 2023, and all the way from Miami to Tampa to New Orleans to Houston and on inland to San Antonio and many, many other locations just inland. It was just an exceptionally hot month, and in part because it simply didn't rain very much, lots of sunshine, and light winds, which allowed the ocean near the Gulf Coast to heat up. And I'm sure many of your listeners know about the record hot temperatures exceeding 100 degrees in parts of the Florida Keys, sea surface temperatures of more than 100 degrees Fahrenheit, 38°C. So those interacted with each other. The hot oceans beget hot temperatures just inland and vice versa. So I do think it's easy to underestimate how awful living in that heat has been, even for folks who didn't perhaps get heat-related illnesses. It's just taken a real psychological toll on friends and family I have there. You know, parties canceled, events canceled, people just kind of cowering inside in the AC.
Yeah, I know that some people have written me from there, and they said the fact that it didn't really cool down at night as much as it normally might was really hard on them psychologically. You just couldn't get a good sleep, and you felt like you were kind of submarining inside a, well, not a jail is too much, but you were definitely inside everywhere you went. But strangely, the Pacific Northwest was not that hot this summer, except for a couple of bouts. We've seen worse, like the 2021 heat dome. And yet, north of us in the Northwest Territories, Yukon and Alaska, they were at least 10 degrees C warmer. They set all-time heat records. You found a spot in the center of North America that wasn't all that hot. Talk to us about the strange distribution of heat this year.
Yes, and it's especially fascinating from having been covering climate change for many years. Back in the days when computer models were relatively coarse and crude, we just didn't have the, you know, the computer power to make the models as good as we have them now. But some of the very first regional climate model depictions of climate change basically had hot spot right in smack in the middle of the continent and cool areas or less hot areas around the ring around it on the coastlines. The idea being that the middle of continents can dry out more easily in hot summers, and so the temperatures will really soar there. Weirdly enough, in North America this summer has been roughly the opposite of that. The least hot areas have been in the center of the continent, Midwest and parts of South Central Canada, whereas it's been extremely hot in the U.S. South, record, you know, all-time record heat, and then some areas way to the north, you know, in Yukon and parts of British Columbia. Of course, there were terrible fires in Kelowna and evacuations in the Kelowna area, and on up in Yellowknife. So some of the key interior settlements in far western Canada suffered from wildfire and of course, associated hot temperatures in a lot of Canada. But I think really the jackpot in terms of relatively tolerable weather has been from Chicago to New York. Granted, there was a very hot several-day heat event in the Midwest and toward the end of August. But on the whole, it hasn't been a horrific summer in those areas. Certainly New York. And interestingly, they've had only a handful of days above 90 degrees in places like New York and Chicago. So that's very unusual. And, you know, I can't speak to exactly why this summer played out exactly that way. There has been interesting work done on what we call the warming hole. I like to call it the heating hole now because it, if you relate it to global heating, right, there's going to be a few places where the heating isn't quite as intense as it is other places. For whatever reason, the U.S. Midwest seems to be one of those, and I think part of it is the densification of agriculture. You simply have such dense planting, and these corn crops and soybean crops evaporate huge amounts of moisture. So you get extremely warm nights, muggy, insufferable heat indices, but the actual daytime temperatures are not as hot as they otherwise might be, whereas in the south and southwest, it's just been a horrible day and night, and very, very dangerous, especially I think in cities like Phoenix, where you have large populations of unhoused people, you know, they're tracking heat deaths a lot more accurately in Phoenix now and finding, you know, 100 or 200 people a year dying now in just Phoenix alone.
Yeah, and, you know, I had to sort of go back and relearn a term, vapor pressure deficit, because so many of our foresters were saying, well, that is what got these forests ready to burn as soon as the lightning set them off. What is vapor pressure deficit, and why does it change as the world warms?
Well, in a nutshell, what's really important for many phenomena is not relative humidity, although that certainly is important with fire, but it's literally the amount of water in the air. And so relative humidity is just that. It's how much water is in the air compared to how much the air will hold. So if your relative humidity is 50%, it's saying maybe there's 5 units of water in the air, but the air you can have up to 10 units before you have 100% humidity. So that's why it's important to, you know, RH is certainly used by firefighters and fire weather folks all the time, but as I understand it, vapor pressure deficit pertains to, and I can't answer that in great detail, but it's related to how much moisture is in the air compared to how much the air can hold at a different temperature. But also how much is essentially being sucked out of the landscape.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, the plants have to respond by pumping more out of their roots, and that helps dry the soil, and eventually they can't get enough to fill what you might call the demand of the atmosphere to hold more moisture. And so they're dried right out, they're tender, they're ready to burn. Well, covering extreme news as we both do, I find small stories can trigger a larger reaction, a kind of a feeling that, whoa, things have really changed. And the first for me, what were those reports that you just spoke to about homeless people in Phoenix? They arrived in emergency wards with third-degree burns from just touching the pavement. And it seems the cities can become too hot for human survival outside the grid. That is the South now, doesn't it seem?
Well, in parts of the South, certainly. I think in the deeper South, you have more trees. I mean, Atlanta is the most kind of shady city in the entire United States. So now, of course, there are parts of even cities in the Southeast U.S. where there's less shade than other parts. I think that sunshine or the shade poverty, you might call it, is worse in a place like Phoenix, where there's a lot of pavement. The cities were just built in semi-arid areas, so it's harder to get shade, and low-income areas are often just barren of shade. In the Southeast, typically trees will grow almost anywhere if you give them a chance. So I think even low-income areas in the South typically have more shade. There was a tradition of building homes in the Southeast to accommodate the climate. For example, shotgun shacks, even very modest houses, would be built with a corridor. The hallway would be on one side of the house, and you could open the front door and back door and get a breeze all the way through the house, and obviously opening the windows too. So architecture was designed to keep people cool. And somehow, God only knows, people lived and survived in the South without air conditioning and in truly awful heat for many, many years. And now that heat is worse, of course. And you have houses that if your air conditioning gives out, you could be in real trouble with heat. I do think in the Southeast, anyway, people have kind of adapted a little bit better. And so you don't have, typically 100 or 200 people dying on the street as you would in, say a place like Phoenix. So in the Southeast, I worry a little more about perhaps if you have the power go out for several days and you got these houses that are just made to store heat and they're reliant on air conditioning, and then if you don't have AC, you're in big trouble. I think if the AC keeps running, then most people can get by in the Southeast. But the problem is, of course, all that AC burning, if it's not from solar or renewable energy, is simply, adding to the problem, right, because it's pumping more greenhouse gases into the air.
This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest is weather watcher Bob Henson. The other story that kind of got to me, and you touched on it, it's New Orleans experienced the hottest day ever in its long record of heat. It's always hot there, but this was nuts. On August 27th, the actual temperature, I think, was 105 degrees Fahrenheit or 40 degrees C. That's a full 2 degrees hotter than the previous record, and it doesn't include the feel-like heat index and that legendary Louisiana humidity. What surprised or triggered you this summer, Bob?
I think it's these temperatures on the Gulf Coast. Having gone to college in Houston and having some family and friends in Nashville, and just I have a fair amount of connections in that part of the U.S. So to see the temperatures that bad there, I'm not sure it's a survivability issue at this point there. I think it's more a psychological survivability issue, as we were alluding to earlier. It's just grindingly awful. And there has been a lot of drought as well. We saw in August, the largest wildfire in Louisiana history developed, consuming tens of thousands of acres. It's just been tinder dry, relentlessly hot. And heat indices, while they've been terrible, the humidity hasn't always been as high as it can be, simply because the landscape is so dry in a large part of the South. But certainly, I know in a lot of areas in midsummer, the heat indices were just insufferable. I don't know. I hope this is a one-off. There's certainly a lot of factors globally this year and in the U.S., but also globally, that's compounded. There's been a convergence of things that have led to extreme heat, including, obviously, the inexorable furthering of global heating, global warming. But on top of that, a couple other things. We have an El Nino building this year, which is intensifying global temperature, as it tends to do. We've had, ironically, one mitigation measure, which is to reduce sulfate shipping pollution across the shipping lane to the North Atlantic. And that's been going on for a couple of years now, these measures to reduce sulfate pollution by like 80-85%. And those are having a real positive impact on air quality, but, they're not blocking the sun. You don't have the pollutants that had been blocking sunlight, so that's allowing the oceans to heat up more. It's a small factor compared to climate change, but it's in the mix, certainly on top of what's going on.
We did talk to Leon Simons, who's been raising that issue, along with James Hansen. Yeah, as you say, it's a small amount of warming, but every small addition can really add up.
Yes, exactly. And there's even the volcano. I don't know to what extent you've addressed that on your show, but the undersea volcano Hunga Tonga that went off at the start of last year pumped something like enough water vapor to raise the amount of water vapor in the stratosphere by roughly 15%. And this has never been observed since we've had satellites and modern observing techniques. So it's a little bit of a wild card, but water vapor is certainly a greenhouse gas, and having it there floating around in the stratosphere, it's going to be there for some time now, a few years probably. That's another incremental push that we weren't anticipating, that is a net addition to surface temperature at low levels where we live. So it certainly is an unhappy constellation of ingredients this year. To add pain to our misery, it's typically the year after El Nino that sees the highest global surface temperature. So there's every reason to believe 2024 will be hotter than 2023. As best I can tell from my own back-of-the-envelope calculations, I don't expect us to bump above 1.5 C over industrial temperatures, pre-industrial. I don't expect to see that for an entire year. We might see that happen for a week or month or two, but it's not the sustained 1.5 C warming that is the real concern that the IPCC has been warning about. That's based on basically a few years running at that level, right? And I think we're still looking at having that, at least not till the late 2020s, if not the early 2030s. But I still think we're at very high risk of hitting that level.
Well, we're edging into it. I had an Indian scientist tell me that India had reached 1.5 for a period of 9 months. And so I think we'll get periods or years where we're right almost there. But as you say, to be a climate change, it has to go on for a while.
Yes, exactly. And I think it's 1.5 is a proxy. There's nothing magic about it. It's simply a level that originally was arrived at from concern about small island states, and that's a level where waters are going to threaten their survival. And the Paris Agreement was to keep climate change to 2.0, but if at all possible, keep it as close to 1.5 C as possible. And then there became increasing momentum to focus on the 1.5, in part because of a lot of research showing that the risks tend to ramp up a little more above 1.5, and especially above 2. So it looked like a good marker, you know, kind of a good yellow light. I think of 1.5 as a strong yellow light and 2 as a red light, personally. Everybody differs on these things, but IPCC certainly came down on the 1.5 C as being a real threshold you need to avoid. But the political system was set up a little more for 2.0 to avoid, and, you know, avoiding 1.5 if we can, right? That was again the Paris Agreement. So I don't see us avoiding 1.5, at least in the short term of the next couple decades. If anything, we might nudge above it.
Bob, have you looked into why heat domes form and stay? I mean, we had one over the southern U.S. for an abnormally long time. There was one appeared over Europe, and Japan was roasting, just setting new records for weeks on end. Are these heat domes setting up due to a slow, meandering jet stream, or is it planetary waves, or do we know?
Well, certainly all those things feed in. I mean, planetary waves are what give you the bubbles of heat and the bubbles of coolness, you know, the dips of, you know, the dips and rises in the jet stream if you're looking at it from an up and down perspective. Yeah, we're better at diagnosing things like heat domes and, you know, upper highs than we are at predicting exactly why they form. And it's a little bit of a process where you can go back and back and back in the causality chain, right? Like, you say, well, it got cold because a cold front hit. Well, why did the cold front hit? Well, because the jet stream dipped. Well, why did the jet stream dip? Well, because of a Rossby wave. Well, why did the Rossby wave form? You know, so there's, you know, ultimately it's it's like a pinball machine. You just have a print of things caroming around and kind of interrelating with each other. And so heat domes have always happened, but to me, we're seeing particularly this year a real spike in the heights of the middle of the atmosphere over the tropics and subtropics. And so sometimes that has pushed heat into the southern tier of the U.S. I think that pertains a lot to why we've seen just such intense heat over the southern states of the U.S. and southwestern states. And in other parts of the world, I think, have seen that reflected as well. When those subtropical heat areas extend up into mid-latitudes. And as you point out, yes, there have been extreme records all over the Northern Hemisphere this summer. And we're going to make a real strong run at the hottest year on record globally, because there have also been very warm winters this year in many Southern Hemisphere areas. Australia and South America in particular have I believe South America's had the warmest winter on record there. I believe Perth got up to 30 degrees C in late August for the first time ever on any winter day. And of course, winter heat is not so gripping in some ways, because sometimes it's just plain pleasant, right? If you're someplace and instead of being frigid, it's you know, 60 or 70 degrees Fahrenheit or 20 C. Like, oh, what's wrong with that? Well, inherently, there's nothing wrong with that specific event, but it's a symptom of something more troubling.
Well, I know that Bolivia hit amazing records. It was over 35 degrees C in the wintertime. And I think part of the problem is there, too. They've got cities that depend entirely on glaciers melting for their drinking water. And, of course, those glaciers, tropical glaciers, are in trouble when it gets that hot, even in the wintertime. And I'm sure plant life and bird life, all those things must be tuned to expect the winter. But when they get summer all year long, it does change things, whether humans are comfortable or not.
It sure does, and we've seen examples of that in the U.S. when, you know, we get winter warm waves and plants start blooming, you know, weeks and months ahead of schedule, and then you get a March or April cold wave. That happened in 2012, I think it was, in Michigan, where many of the crops there were more or less wiped out. I think there have been some examples of that with peach crops in the United States this summer, both with cold waves and warm waves. You know, and drought wiping out different aspects of the peach crop. So peach prices are apparently really high over a lot of the United States this year. So,
and yet I feel like cautioning some of my friends by saying, well, but we could still get really cold events in some winter times, because I think what's happened here is it's been destabilized and we're getting extremes of all kinds, more warm than cold for sure, but the cold could still come.
Absolutely. I think the poster child for that is the cold wave of February 2021 in Texas, the one that led to more than 100 deaths, I think maybe over more than 200 deaths, and many of those from people firing up generators inside to stay warm, and then carbon monoxide poisoning. It was just an awful event in many ways, and that was, you know, the absolute temperatures were not necessarily the coldest on record in every location, but the duration of time below freezing and you know, deep into Texas was close to unprecedented, and the power grid was just not well adapted. So in part, that was a human failing. But yeah, we have to remember that, cold outbreaks can and will still happen, even in a warming climate. That's part of the interest in the research on the connections between the Arctic and mid-latitude, which continues to be a very fascinating area of science research and scientific debate. There are perfectly solid scientists on both sides of that debate, looking at things through different lenses and arguing, well, we're going to see more of these polar vortex intrusions and more winter extremes, and others saying, well, on the whole, when you look at all the winter cold, it's not as bad as it used to be and should continue to not be as bad. And so a part of it is just which lens you're looking at it from, but regardless, I think the main message is just that a warming climate does not insulate you or inoculate you against the potential for really damaging winter weather.
And you have another big project you're working on. Are you ready to talk about that yet, Bob?
Actually, I'm mostly working on the things that I've long been interested in. I'm really enjoying doing the coverage for Yale Climate Connections with my longtime colleague, Dr. Jeff Masters. So we still do our department at Yale called Eye on the Storm, which is covering extreme weather, in particular hurricanes, but other things as well, and relating that to the relevant climate change research. So I really enjoy doing that and get a lot of satisfaction out of it. And we have a fantastic active readership that comments on our stuff, which is, you know, many places I've gotten rid of their comment section, but we have a very active one, very active support from moderators, volunteer moderators. So I'm doing that, and I still am co-author on a couple of meteorology textbooks. I still have my own climate change book called The Thinking Person's Guide to Climate Change out there. And so, yeah, occasionally I'll write for the Washington Post, Capital Weather Gang, and other venues, including Texas Climate News, where I've been a contributing editor for several years. So I enjoy what I do, getting the word out, even though sometimes it's it can be pretty troubling what we have to cover. I try to keep a sense of perspective. I've always been a worried optimist when it comes to climate change, and that we can do a lot and we have to do a lot to keep the impacts worse and to keep it from getting worse, to mitigate and to reduce emissions. And I'm still passionate about that. I've had a plug-in hybrid car now for 10 years, and it's essentially been about half of an electric car because about half of all the miles I've put it on it have been purely electric. And I think that's one of many solutions that have been underused, and unfortunately now we're moving toward all electric cars. But, you know, there are people in places where it's hard, still difficult to go all electric for cars. But we could do so much more than we're doing on cars, on having solar panels, especially in sunny parts of the United States. But certainly solar panels can work just fine in Canada, too, and get a lot of energy there. So I really want to see solutions implemented, and I'm passionate about that, and I hope to do more communicating and writing about that as we go hurtling forward into the mid-2020s.
We've been speaking with the worried optimist, Bob Henson. He's recognized as one of the best weather watchers out there and as a top science journalist. Bob, where should listeners go to keep up with your work?
Well, I'm on Twitter, X, or whatever we call it, at B. Henson Weather. I'm also on Spoutable, also at B. Henson Weather. We'll probably be experimenting with some more platforms as time goes by. And also, you know, folks can read up on my stuff at yaleclimateconnections.org.
That's where I've been tuning into your work. I love reading your stuff. Find links to the news and science we've talked about in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. For Radio EcoShock, I'm Alex Smith. Thank you so much, Bob.
Oh, thanks for having me, Alex. Great to talk with you again.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
In the United States, 40 local and state governments are suing fossil fuel companies for damages caused by climate change. In Canada, West Coast Environmental Law is leading the charge to make fossil fuel producers and emitters pay up. Environmental lawyer Andrew Gage coordinates the Sue Big Oil campaign. From Victoria, B.C., Andrew Gage, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
Give us your impressions of the 2023 fire season in Canada's West Coast for our international listeners.
Well, I mean, where I am, we've been relatively fortunate, just some smoke occasionally, but, you know, clearly tens of thousands of people evacuated, many structures burnt in the interior. This is in many ways a repeat of some of the earlier very devastating wildfire seasons we've had. And, of course, it's also part of the national crisis that we're having this year with evacuations in the north and in other provinces, as well as just large areas burnt and some record-setting burning wildfires. And certainly when I was a child, even until a few years ago, the idea that we would just have smoke-filled summers and we should expect a wildfire season was that was not something that happened for the most part. And now we're having them, seems like, pretty much every other year.
And when cities like Yellowknife or West Kelowna evacuate, it costs someone billions of dollars. Businesses shut down, firefighting budgets go through the roof, the military comes in, tens of thousands of people have to be fed and housed and get around, and then the super high costs of rebuilding kick in, and a lot of that big money comes one way or another from taxpayers. Andrew, who do you think should pay?
Well, I mean, the reality is we're all going to pay, but I think the question is, why isn't the fossil fuel industry paying at least some of it, and what is their fair share? This is an industry that has made hundreds of billions of dollars, trillions of dollars over the years, selling the very products that cause climate change. They've known that would be the result. They've actually worked very hard to delay anything that would move consumers away from using oil, gas, and coal globally. And yet they take no responsibility for the harm that their products and their actions in delaying that transition to a more sustainable energy source have caused. So absolutely. You know, our view is that it is self-evident that the fossil fuel industry, oil, gas, and coal, should be paying a share of those costs, and the question we should be debating is how much.
Andrew, why does this kind of case matter?
Well, I think that there's a couple of reasons. One is that our communities literally cannot afford the costs of preparing for climate change. In Canada, the Insurance Bureau of Canada estimates that local governments across our country should be spending $5.3 billion every year to prepare for the cost of climate change and minimize the impacts of climate change. We have not begun to wrap our heads around how we're going to pay for this. And, of course, the default, if we don't do anything, is that it comes at the expense of either higher taxes or cuts to services or these necessary, you know, disaster prevention measures not being done. But equally, or maybe even more importantly, it's about making sure that the costs of climate change are on the balance sheets of global fossil fuel companies. Because we've seen what happens over the years when oil and gas companies and coal companies believe that they can make all the profits from selling their products, oil, gas, and coal, without taking any responsibility for the harm that they know they're causing. And that's why we've seen these misinformation campaigns. That's why we've seen companies peddling false solutions and lobbying against climate action and developing patents or holding patents, buying patents on renewable technologies that they never develop. Last year, or within the last year, BP, Shell, and Suncor, among others, have said, we can't afford to go ahead with our commitments on climate change because we're just making too much money from fossil fuels. And as long as you have that dynamic where this industry has all of the profits and none of the responsibility, they're going to continue making those types of business decisions that harm our planet and harm our communities. So this type of lawsuit, in addition to getting much-needed resources for communities to prepare for climate change and deal with the impacts, is really focused on, you know, how do we change the business dynamics and the perceived profitability of this industry that actually is a climate debtor and not a wealth creator? How do we make sure that that is seen? And that changes not just their own investment decisions and their own business decisions, but also the decisions of investors and governments that see this industry incorrectly. I think it's the goose that's laying the golden eggs because they don't have to pay for any of the costs. So it's vitally important that we've come up with new and better ways to hold responsible anyone who's profiting directly from the destruction of the planet.
And do you see relationships between the history of public awareness of the tobacco to cancer link, and that was followed by huge liability suits, and public awareness of the causes of climate change, and then now legal action?
Absolutely. Not just tobacco also. I think asbestos, opioids. I mean, whenever there's an industry that has known that its products are going to cause massive harm, loss of life, these impacts, and have actively hidden that connection and tried to mislead the public and continue selling their products, liability generally has followed. This is not something exceptional. This is what we should expect. And I think it's because the oil and gas industry has done such an effective job of convincing us that this is somehow uniquely the consumer's fault and that they're just providing a product, that they've avoided this conversation for so long. But if we are all responsible for climate change, then the fossil fuel industry has to be also partly responsible, and they've managed to escape any responsibility and any conversation about what that responsibility is until these lawsuits.
So lawsuits against big oil, coal, and gas have a longer history in the United States in general, in sort of broad brush strokes. What is happening there, and how is it going?
As you say, it goes back a few years. There were some lawsuits filed in the early 2000s that were unsuccessful because of legal issues that really don't arise in Canada for the most part. Questions about whether cases should be filed in state or federal court and whether the federal common law has been displaced by the Clean Air Act. And those cases, you know, were unsuccessful, and then there was sort of a lull for a second. And now we've seen a real resurgence of cases being filed by both local governments and states in state courts using a fairly wide range of legal theories, but generally coming back to these companies knew what their products were doing, they misled the public, they've therefore contributed to the harm that local governments and state governments are experiencing now and will be experiencing in the future. There's now 41, I think, actually, communities that are part of one of these lawsuits one way or another, the most recent one being filed by Multnomah County in Oregon for about $50 billion U.S., so significant claims being made.
What can the legal history or what we've learned in the United States, can it help people and governments in other countries like in Canada or even the EU?
We can. A lot of the U.S. cases, at least the second generation of cases, has been tied up in technical issues about the level of courts the cases should be filed in. And so only a few of them have gotten to really considering whether they have an arguable case, whether the oil and gas and coal companies have a case to be answered. But those cases are very informative. There's a decision from Hawaii confirming that the fact that the industry misled the public and was involved in this misinformation campaigns can itself be, in addition to the harm they've caused by selling their products, this misinformation campaign can itself be a basis for claiming liability. There's also claims that have been filed in Europe, notably by Friends of the Earth Netherlands and by a Peruvian farmer, but in German courts against a German coal company, that have established that there are sort of arguable cases under European law as well. And those are also things that the Canadian potentially U.S., but more likely Canadian courts might look to.
Well, tell us about the suit you and your group, West Coast Environmental Law, are launching in Canada.
Well, I'd love to say we were actually launching it just now, but actually the Sue Big Oil campaign is pressing local governments to bring this case. I mean, basically what we're saying is, as taxpayers, as residents of these communities, we need our local governments not to just be passing the costs of climate change that they're experiencing on to us as taxpayers or us as members of the community, but to be seeking to recover those costs, taking the fiscally responsible step of actually looking for compensation and reimbursement of those costs from the industry that's done so much to cause those impacts. The alternative is we all pay 100% of the cost. So the Sue Big Oil campaign is asking BC local governments to come together and file a class action lawsuit. We've had a couple wins in terms of local governments saying, yes, we want to participate in that. We'll put funds aside for it. But we're looking for a critical mass of municipalities to come together before the lawsuit will actually be filed. So it's not been launched just yet. And we're hoping it will move forward quickly, but we've still got ways to go.
Well, I like to keep our listeners apprised of the science behind a lot of this, and we have two studies that came from experts employed by the Union of Concerned Scientists. In 2017, Brenda Eckwurzel led the paper titled "The Rise in Global Atmospheric CO2, Surface Temperature, and Sea Level Emissions Traced to Major Carbon Producers," and that was followed in 2019 by Rachel Licker's look, "Attributing Ocean Acidification to Major Carbon Producers." Do you feel there are solid links directly from damages caused by, say, wildfires or flooding to the big carbon producers? Can we prove this?
Absolutely. I mean, and there's a third Union Concerned Scientists paper that was looking at the area burnt due to wildfires and linking back to fossil fuel production. The science that those papers are relying on or use estimates the increase in the likelihood of these events and the severity of these events, and to what degree can that be tied both to climate change generally and then to the emissions that are traceable to these particular companies. It's extremely important work. That being said, a lot of the costs that communities experience from climate change are much easier to link than those particular extreme wildfires. Whenever a municipality has to put in a larger storm drain because climate change is causing more extreme precipitation during the winter, you can say, well, the increase in size of that pipe was actually tied to climate change. So there's a lot of costs that municipalities experience that are much less dramatic, but are no less real, and in fact, in many cases, are actually easier to draw that connection.
Yeah, that 2018 paper by Megan Kirchmer-Young at the Pacific Climate Impacts Consortium at the University of Victoria, she studied the record wildfire season in BC in 2017, over 1.2 million hectares burned. That's almost 3 million acres for our American listeners. And she found that, quote, anthropogenic climate change increased the area burned by a factor of 7 to 11 times. That sounds like a pretty big influence, all right.
It is. I mean, in fairness, that paper does qualify that a bit in noting that there were other factors that weren't fully assessed. But I think it's pretty clear that the impacts we've seen in 2017 as well as in 2018 and this year and in 2021, as I say, these are happening really frequently. There's a big connection there.
Well, one more to pass on to listeners. It's kind of the latest scientific smoking gun. It's a paper published May 16th, 2023 by Christina Dahl and her co-authors. And she says, quote, "What we did in this study was attribute a portion of the increase in fire danger conditions and cumulative area burned across the western U.S. and southwestern Canada to emissions that you can trace back to 88 of the world's largest fossil fuel producers and cement manufacturers. What we found is that these fossil fuel producers and cement manufacturers are responsible for almost 40% of the area of western U.S. and southwestern Canadian forests that have burned since the mid-1980s, and they're responsible for about half of the increase in fire danger conditions that's happened over the last century. So that's a huge impact that you can trace right back to 88 named companies. We're talking about people like, I guess, Shell Oil and BP and the usual suspects.
Yeah. I mean, this paper, the paper you're talking about, as well as the other two you referenced, are based on the work of Richard Heaty, a scientist who's actually quantified how much greenhouse gases can be traced back to particular companies. And it's been really influential work, and the union concerned scientists and others are taking that in these directions and saying, if you take those figures, how much, you know, actual impact has that had on these different types of weather events?
How do you picture this case proceeding? What sort of damages might participating local governments demand?
Yeah, so we eventually want a lead local government, or more likely more than one, who actually have their names attached to the case. And they would be bringing the case on behalf of all BC local governments that are harmed by climate change. And the focus probably would be on the cost of preparing for climate change, because most communities, all communities, have those types of costs in common. One of the first stages of a class action lawsuit is that the judge will confirm that the case should proceed as a class action, and as part of that, that the case has legal merit, that the case could be won by the municipalities. So very early on in our process, we would get a ruling saying that the local governments could win, and that, you know, that presumably is going to be appealed. But at the end of the day, we would get a ruling saying, here's what local governments will have to prove in order to be successful, or not. The judges and the courts were to rule that there wasn't a case, you know, we'd have to go back to the drawing board. But we're fairly confident that the answer will be yes, there is a case here. The judge would also certify what are known as the common issues, the issues that all of the municipalities have in, collectively, things like, are municipalities a proper plaintiff to bring this type of case? What type of damages can they claim for? Are the defendants appropriate defendants? What would they have to be proved to show that they were responsible? Questions about what each municipality might have be entitled to receive in compensation is not a common issue. That would be something to be dealt with at a further stage of the legal process. Now, one of the differences between Canada and the U.S. is the U.S. has a whole tradition of mass tort litigation with punitive damages being heard before jury trials. The Canadian context is quite different. It's generally not jury trials. The damages awards are, you know, I think, appropriate to the harm caused, but that don't include the same element of punishment. And so class action, you know, where the U.S. cases have generally been funded primarily by attorneys taking the cases on a contingency basis, a class action in Canada allows municipalities to pool resources to bring the case where they may have to put more of the funds up front otherwise.
So, Andrew, you were an environmental activist in BC, and then, as I understand it, after being arrested at Clackwood Sound on the roadblock to logging, you went back to university to become a lawyer? Is that the trajectory?
That's correct, yeah.
And then you're a member of the Society of Friends, also known as the Quakers. And you, in the early days of Radio EcoShock, I did a short piece on the gifts of the Quakers, from the right to assembly right up to inspiring and founding Greenpeace in Vancouver. It's a proud history. Talk to us about the role of environmental activism plays in your life and in your family.
I think I was raised believing that it is very important that we take responsibility for actions and that we take responsibility for our relationship to the planet and to helping each other, helping our communities, helping our each other grow. I went to university looking for ways that I could sort of be of help and leave the world sort of better than I found it. I think that comes both out of, yeah, just my upbringing, but also my sort of personal religious beliefs. And it's definitely a value that I've tried to pass on to my children and that our family tries to live as well. So, you know, my daughter's also been involved in climate strikes. She's now 17, and she carries on that sort of tradition of what can we do to help balance a relationship to the natural world that hasn't always been in balance.
All generations are going to have to take part in this if we have a hope of having a habitable planet, in my opinion. From West Coast Environmental Law, we've been speaking with lawyer Andrew Gage. He's helping to try and get going a lawsuit by local governments in Canada for damages against big fossil fuel producers. You can get links to the science we talked about in my show blog at ecoshock.org. You can find out more about this campaign at www.suebigoil.ca. Andrew, thanks for your work in climate justice. We appreciate it, and thanks for talking with us today.
My pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
What are the scientists thinking? This is Kevin Anderson speaking in 2023.
If we think about where we're heading, let's be clear. We are over 30 years, 32 years now, since the first major scientific report on climate change that came out in 1990. And so I think when we judge where we are heading, we have to say, well, what have we done since 1990? Well, we've watched emissions go up year after year after year. They're now over 60% higher per year than they were in 1990. So there is lots that you will hear, lots of rhetoric, lots of good words, lots of optimism about the future. But given we've known about this subject and apparently been working on it for 30 years, the trend line tells us that we are heading towards 3 to 4 degrees centigrade of warming across this century, an absolute climate catastrophe. It's a catastrophe for all species, including our own. And so that's the direction of travel. Now, that direction of travel does not have to continue, but the current trend line tells us that all we are doing so far is giving rhetoric and optimism and greenwash and not driving the levels of change that are necessary to stay within the 1.5 to 2 degrees framing of the Paris Agreement.
So who is Kevin Anderson? For years, he was deputy director of the top UK climate institution, the Tyndall Centre. Anderson literally advised governments and the European Commission on climate change while fostering key research. He is a professor of energy and climate change, joint chair of the School of Engineering at Manchester. He's with the Center for Sustainability at Uppsala University in Sweden. He's been connected with Bergen University in Norway. And Kevin Anderson says we are on the path to climate catastrophe while we pretend otherwise. In previous shows with experts like Matthew England and Jason Box, find links in my blog, Radio EcoShock has reported the ice world at both poles is in serious retreat at a frightening pace. The Antarctic sea ice is so low, we don't know what is going on. With recent study, we know the great glaciers are melting at both poles. Sea level will rise, and much more than predicted. Your coming headlines in the decades will be coastal towns and cities retreating after mass damages. The vast food-producing deltas lost to salt will not be reported. The extinction of species from coral to microalgae feeding the sea creatures all around, that will not be televised. Millions of people fleeing the heat, drought, fires, and starvation will be on TV. Please listen again to my interview with Gaia Vince. That's in my April 26 show called Nomad Century and Bad Banks, available free at ecoshock.org, of course. Let's talk about the southern heat wave. Winter heat waves deserve more attention wherever they happen, even though humans enjoy them. This past July was the hottest ever experienced in Brazil. In August, it got worse, with temperatures soaring to 42 degrees C, 107 Fahrenheit, in the shade in winter. According to weather historian Maximiliano Herrera, the 45 degrees C recorded August 22 in Villamontes, Bolivia, ties the highest temperature ever recorded in meteorological winter in the whole southern hemisphere. Also in the southern winter, record highs were set in South Africa, from Cape Town, 32.9 degrees C, 91 Fahrenheit, to Namibia. Bob Henson mentioned the 30 degrees at Perth Airport in Australia recently, the hottest winter day at 79 years of record keeping. On all three continents, I guess people enjoyed the winter heat, but nervously. Their coming summer looks ominous indeed, as El Nino really kicks in. And those are just the reports from human settlements on land. The global sea surface temperature anomaly is literally off the charts from anything we have ever seen. That means the ocean is hotter, on average, around the world than ever before in human history. The North Atlantic is cooking, as is the Gulf of Mexico, where sea temperatures near Louisiana reached 90 degrees C hot tub temperatures before that last hurricane came. One place off Florida measured sea temperatures higher than the human body, above 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit, 37 C. I can't call a scientist to find out what that means. Nobody knows. This is a whole new experiment with a closely connected web of living things inside of it. Who says we are going to fly well past the so-called guardrails of 1.5 degrees C or 2 degrees warming? Pretty well every major scientist I know, of course. A majority of the public suspect it. But only the oil and gas industry can guarantee we go to catastrophe. And they do. One of the world's largest oil and gas producers, ExxonMobil, says global climate goals are destined to fail. In late August, the company released its report called ExxonMobil Global Outlook, Our View to 2050. There's no apologies here. The Exxon researchers foresee a 25% increase in world population and a doubling of the global economy by 2050. The company plans to be there all the way, selling profitable oil and gas right past 2050 to fill demand for what they call, quote, a reliable and lower emissions source of fuel for electricity generation, hydrogen production, and heating. Lower emissions? Then what? It's like the mafia saying the neighborhood is growing and people are going to want more drugs, more gambling, and sex. The mafia just fills demand more safely than those other gangs. Where companies like British Petroleum once promised to go beyond petroleum, the oil and gas majors are spending trillions on more production to last long into this century. Governments are not just helping. Governments are spending trillions of dollars to subsidize more drilling, more production. They're even approving more coal plants in the UK and in Australia. Can you believe it? More mines. Fossil fuel addiction has taken over the global brain network.
Well, the fireworks are over. Only the smoke remains, clouding my great crystal ball.
As I have said before, most of us will stumble on somehow until we can't. The universe will continue to reveal its secrets in fantastic galaxies and amazing new life. Love will not die. Art and song may flourish. The privileged few and the lucky will be glad to enjoy parts of life and the days. We may be passing through a step-like transition of terror with a couple of years where disasters pause again before the next jolt. I hope so, but we don't know. This was a pleasant and productive summer for me, although two cities next to our village almost burned down a month ago. In just a few hours, a massive wildfire roared out of the United States and ranged all above the hills over the desert town of Soyuz. It was one of the most frightening night images I've ever seen. Then another big fire flared up in the food-producing Okanagan Valley, causing the evacuation of parts of Kelowna. I tell you, the images on the local evening news were just terrifying. As the smoke rolled into our village, we might be next. We lost a big part of Canada to fire this year. Giant Arctic lands had to be evacuated, including the capital city, Yellowknife. People had to give up. You know, people talk about settling the Arctic during global warming, but humans had to run away while the fire ruled. It was only human to freak out. I'm still freaked out. Since 1988, I have tracked and recorded breaking science and weather news around the world. In the past 2 months, my collection lines were swamped. They just overflowed. My system broke down. My brain could not compute. It's all going to take at least a year to understand the weather shift that just happened and how much of it is permanent. But we may not get time for that. After Hurricane Idalia in Florida and Super Typhoon Saula crashed into Hong Kong and the Chinese mainland, and punishing heat storms all over, there will be another and another. Then it may be Australia's turn in the barrel. Who knows? Nature offered us a good survival niche for 10,000 years. It was like a kind of peace pact. We broke it, and now we find out what happens. In the next few weeks, I've got excellent guests lined up, top experts speaking to you directly about their new work. Plus, there are a couple of crazy plots developing. For example, if we clean up air pollution, would that alone trigger fatal climate change? Please stay tuned. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about your world, all of it.
Tell your friends about Radio Free Kansas, especially weather on Wednesday. It's surely the news of these weather events around the world must be affecting the stubborn. Tell your friends about Weather on Wednesday and Radio Free Kansas. It's well worth the time, and I really appreciate what Alex Smith is doing up there in Canada. We're going to have a short musical break, and then we'll have Maria Gallardin's TUC Radio. Yeah, go to ecoshock.org. Eco, that's ecoshoch.org. And throw a few bucks, you can do that. He's in Canada. Don't hurt yourself, but send a few bucks $5 means a lot to all of us who are making these productions for you. Here's a very interesting hookup song, Wishing and Waiting for Love, from 1924.
I'm always round by my lonesome, wishing and waiting for love.
Well, you wonder, you know, that, like I said, that song is almost 100 years old. Very interesting how things have changed. Coming up, TUC Radio, and an argument about whether it was good to build all these reservoirs and the Hoover Dam and stopping the Colorado River way back in the 30s. You be the judge.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. What makes our lights go on? The epic struggle over dams, displaced people, and the environment. This is the subtitle of a recent book by Jacques Leslie, a foreign correspondent turned nonfiction writer who once covered the war on Vietnam for the LA Times. And this is a program from the TUC Radio Archives. I met Jacques Leslie in December of 2006 at his book release event in Corte Madera, California. Now, in 2023, I'm happy to say that much has changed since Leslie's book. We had major dam and spillway failures that flooded communities below the dam, even in California. And in contrast, we had low stream flows that turned reservoir lakes into moonscapes. And there's good news of positive action. Jacques Leslie reported in April of 2023 that the era of building big dams draws to a close, and the era of dam removals has begun. The Iron Gate Dam on the Lower Klamath River is one of four dams that will be torn down to restore salmon fisheries. Here's the archival program from 2006. When Jacques Leslie did a cover story for Harper's Magazine entitled Running Dry, What Happens When the World No Longer Has Enough Fresh Water, he began a lasting involvement with the environmental and political issues of water. What Jacques Leslie discovered when he wrote for Harper's was that, quote, at the core of every argument about water are dams, the modern pyramids, generators of extravagantly apportioned electricity, water storage, and environmental and social disasters. Some dams are so huge that they can be seen from space. Millions of people have been displaced and some of the most fertile land been drowned. In spite of their size, dams are not forever. Sooner or later, they will all silt up and become expensive waterfalls. They pose a constant looming danger to life downstream when they fall into disrepair or are damaged by earthquakes or acts of war. Nevertheless, the building of large dams continues, much of it promoted and funded by the World Bank. Here is Jacques Leslie. He begins by reading about the 1935 dedication of the Hoover Dam in Nevada, near Las Vegas.
At Hoover's September 30, 1935 dedication, Interior Secretary Harold Ickes exactly reflected the common understanding when he declared, pridefully, man acclaims his conquest of nature. Hoover's image became one of the nation's most popular exports. After it, every country wanted dams, and every major country, regardless of ideology, built them. Between Hoover and the end of the century, more than 45,000 large dams at least five stories tall, were built in 140 countries. By now, the planet has expended $2 trillion on dams, the equivalent of the entire 2003 U.S. government budget. The world's dams have shifted so much weight, the geophysicists believe they have slightly altered the speed of the Earth's rotation, the tilt of its axis, and the shape of its gravitational field. They adorn 60% of the world's 200-plus major river basins, and the water behind them blots out a terrain bigger than California. Their turbines generate a fifth of the world's electricity supply, and the water they store makes possible as much as a sixth of the Earth's food production. Take away Hoover Dam, and you take away a bearing, a confidence, a sense of what nations are for. Yet in a sense, that's what's happening. Even if Hoover lasts another 1,100 years, by which time Bureau of Reclamation officials say Lake Mead will be filled with sediment, turning the dam into an expensive waterfall, its teleological edifice has already begun to crumble. In seven decades, we have learned that if you take away Hoover, you also take away millions of tons of salt that the Colorado once carried to the sea, but that have instead been strewn across the irrigated landscape, slowly poisoning the soil. Take away the Colorado River dams and you return the silt gathering behind them to a free-flowing river, allowing it again to enrich the downstream wetlands and the once fantastically abundant, now often caked, arid, and refuse-fouled delta. Take away the dams and the Cocopah Indians, whose ancestors fished and farmed the delta for more than a millennium, might have a chance of avoiding cultural extinction. Take away the dams, and the Colorado would again bring its nutrients to the Gulf of California, helping that depleted fishery to recover the status it held a half century ago as an unparalleled repository of marine life. Take away the dams, finally, and the Colorado River returns to its virgin state, tempestuous, fickle, in some stretches, astonishing. Now, it happened when I began to look into writing a book about dams that there was in existence something called the World Commission on Dams. This was formed by the World Bank in the mid-1990s out of its frustration in building dams. Indeed, they had run into so much opposition on some of their biggest projects that they'd been forced to pull out of a project for the first time in their history. And they were growing increasingly frustrated, even desperate, to figure out a way to cut through this opposition. The opponents had been calling for quite a long time for the creation of an independent commission that would study all of the dam's bank projects, come to some conclusions about their benefits, their detriments, and then make recommendations on how they ought to be built in the future. And finally, the bank said, all right, let's create this independent commission. It made one interesting caveat, however, and that was that instead of simply studying the bank's dams, it would study all large dams, all 45,000 dams, the idea apparently being to divert attention from the many fiascos that the dam had sponsored. The opponents were happy to agree to the formation of such a commission because they believed that an honest study would confirm what they'd been saying about dams. And so this commission was formed. People were nominated for the 12 commissioner positions, and they were divided into three groups. There were four people who were going to be anti-dam, four who were in the middle, and four who were pro-dam. And indeed, the commission was formed and it was chosen that way. It met for 2.5 years. It oversaw the most thorough study of dams that has ever been done. Its final report was issued in November 2000. It was remarkably critical of dams, given the composition of the commission. And it made 26 recommendations for how they ought to be built in the future. They were so rigorous that the bank took one look at these recommendations and turned its back on its own creation, said, never mind, and has since then gone back to a policy of building as many large dams as quickly as it can. For a writer, however, the commission had a benefit, and that was that I borrowed its structure. I decided to write about one person from each of those three groups, one pro-dam, one in the middle, one anti-dam. In India, I wrote about a woman named Medha Patkar, who is considered the world's foremost anti-dam activist, a woman who has fought against the Sardar Sarovar Dam, this monstrous dam, by some measures the second or third largest dam in the world, on the Narmada River in western India. She started a group called the Narmada Bachao Andolan, or the Save the Narmada Movement, in the late 1980s. Then proceeded to go on hunger strikes of 17, 20, 22, and 26 days, coming right up to the edge of losing her life in her opposition to this dam. She also tried drowning herself in rising reservoir water. At one point, the water reached right here when the Indian police pulled her out to save the Indian government the embarrassment of her death. And she was an absolutely extraordinary person to spend time with, as I did. I also wrote about an anthropologist now retired from the California Institute of Technology named Thayer Scudder, who's considered the world's leading authority on dam resettlement. He has done most of his work in southern Africa, so we went together to a number of projects there. And finally, I wrote about Don Blackmore, the manager of the only major river system in Australia. He is in a commission that manages it. And although he certainly is not opposed to the idea of dams, he found that his job during the 14 years of his tenure consisted of trying to persuade farmers and politicians that they'd taken too much water out of this river. Indeed, its flow is now a little over a quarter of what it was before there were dams and other diversions. And as a result, the river is dying, and so are large tracts of land along the river in quite devastating ways. So first, let me read you a passage about Maida Patkar. I first saw her at something called the World Water Forum, which was organized by the World Bank. This was in 2000 in The Hague. And she was appearing there with Arundhati Roy, who many of you probably know, a writer who won the Booker Prize for The God of Small Things and has been a great supporter of Maida, and in fact gave the money that she won in that award to Maida's organization. Maida was formal, ideological, impersonal, and unceasingly serious. She said privatization didn't acknowledge the contribution of local people, the people who tended the forest and got displaced by dams because they weren't investors. She said privatization rewarded cash crops, which meant that poor people who depended on subsistence agriculture went hungry. Nearly yelling, she said, states now are puppets of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. It wasn't until a year later, when I spent a month in Cape Town, the headquarters of the World Commission on Dams, that I began to suspect I'd gotten things backward. The commission secretariat members were mostly water experts, few of whom believed that the dam debate was as one-sided as Maida did, and they weren't noted particularly for humility or guilelessness, yet they spoke about Maida with awe, a hint of reverence, as if simultaneously acknowledging her stature and vulnerability. Everyone called her by her first name. Even the engineers and capitalists across the ideological abyss, who are as enthusiastically pro-dam as anti, treated her gently. It was understandable, they said, that Maida would fight for displaced people, but their plight did not invalidate dams. Most people spoke of her toughness, her determination, her willingness to suffer. I learned that Maida declined to eat her meals during a flight to a commission meeting in Cairo and gave the food to Cairo's street children after disembarking. I was told that Maida attended one commission session immediately after a week-long hunger strike and threw up everything she ate. A staff member eventually found her some plain yogurt, which she kept down. And I was told that during the heated last weeks of negotiations over the commission's final report, Maida was the only commissioner who won, as the price of her signature, the placement of an individual comment at the report's end, in which he bemoaned the commission's refusal to consider Dam's relation to the, quote, unjust and destructive dominant development model, unquote, globalization. Of the commissioners, Maida was the best known, the most outspoken, the most politically sharply defined, yet against all the odds, she was the most admired and in a certain way cared for. Now, let me go to a very different personality, Thayer Scudder, in Africa. Professor Thayer Scudder, the world's leading dam resettlement expert, did not want to go with me to Zambia. More precisely, he did not want to accompany me to Mzulu, the village in Zambia where for nearly a century he'd chronicled a social catastrophe set off by a dam. At its completion in 1959, the dam, an artless slab of arched cement named Kariba, rose the equivalent of a 48-story building above its Zambezi River floor. It was then the biggest dam in Africa and formed the world's largest reservoir, which instantly became the world's largest man-made thing. Kariba is the first large dam financed by the World Bank, which lavished on it the largest loan in the first decade of its history. From the air, the reservoir resembles a giant caterpillar with tributaries for legs. It obliterates 175 miles of upstream river and an average of 10 miles of terrain on either side. On that alluvial soil, enriched with sediment born from Africa's core, the Tonga of the Gwembe Valley had survived for thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands, of years. To make room for the reservoir, the dam's British colonial builders uprooted 57,000 Tonga, two-thirds their entire number, and forced them into resettlement sites on barren land. In 1956, before the dam was finished, Scudder spent nearly a year in Mzulu conducting an anthropological study of its 6,000 citizens. In the 4.5 decades that followed, he paid 18 extended visits to them in their resettlement village, called New Mizzou. In the beginning, Scudder had no inkling that he would document a disaster. He believed in dams, even as he constructed miniature caribas and termite mounds to show Mizzou villagers how their land would be inundated. They reacted with what he called great merriment and disbelief at the thought that a structure 60 miles away could affect them. It wasn't until the mid-1970s, after the villagers had seemed to recover from the shock of resettlement only to founder, that Scudder realized his job consisted of charting the disintegration of Tonga culture. Now he calls involuntary resettlement the worst thing you can do to people other than kill them. In the spring of 2002, when I was proposing the trip, Scudder's Mizzou informants reported that village residents were demoralized and hungry, and Scudder lacked the stomach, or perhaps the heart, for a first-hand look. He said we could go to Lesotho, the tiny African kingdom where he was ending a 13-year stint as a consultant on a huge dam project. And we could visit Botswana, where he'd played a crucial role in stopping a dam that would have harmed the Okavango Delta, a Connecticut-sized puddle of astonishing wildlife. But at Mizzou, he said, there's little to see. I'd have to go there without him, and indeed I did. Scudder's distress was as much intellectual as emotional. It arose not just from watching villagers of long acquaintance suffer and die, though that registered. It was, in a way, more personal, more fundamental, because it ate at the assumptions on which his career in dams is based. Again and again, he admired a dam in plan, lent support to its construction as consultant, and then, after documenting its failures of implementation and its social and environmental damage, grew disillusioned. His disillusionment has spread to his frequent employer, the World Bank, for failing to enforce its own resettlement and environmental policies, but it stops at the threshold of economic development itself. The conflict in his mind pits the concept of development, in which he has always believed, against all the evidence he has gathered of its failures. If dams, the centerpieces in every development project that includes them, repeatedly fail to produce environmental stability or even a modicum of economic justice, then what is left of development? And if development fails, as it so spectacularly has in Africa, then what will fill the gap between rich and poor? What will prevent a billion or two of the world's poorest people from unrelenting suffering and hopeless, squalid death? For Scudder, a kind of Dag Hammarskjöld internationalist, a successful dam would confirm a worldview. At 71, he was still looking for one good dam. Finally, I wrote about Australia, the world's most arid continent, where this the River Murray flows through a kind of ribbon of water. To give you a sense of this river, although it's the 16th longest river in the world, its flow in 1 year is less than the Amazon's in 1 day. And that gives you an idea of the preciousness of water in Australia. Because so much water has been diverted, at the bottom of the river, right next to the mouth, there's a 9-mile-long lagoon called the Coorong, which used to be an absolutely extraordinary place where migratory birds came from as far away as Siberia, 7,000 miles away, and dined on the fish by the hundreds of thousands. Now, as a result of all these diversions and the impacts that they've had, and then the building of weirs along the River Murray, and then barrages very close to the mouth, the Coorong is increasingly saline. There is now about one-tenth of the fish that there used to be and one-tenth of the birds. It's virtually dead. The mouth of the river is now so weakened because there's so little flow reaching it that it threatens to close up with sand. And sand has come in and inundated the mudflats on which those birds ate in the lagoon. It's quite a disaster. I wanted to find someone who had lived along the lagoon, and indeed it was only the Aboriginals who had done that, and a man named Tom Trevorrow gave me a tour of the lagoon. Tavaro is a member of the Narindiri community, which once flourished in the Kurong and along 250 miles of the Murray Corridor. The Narindiri comprised one of the largest of Australia's Aboriginal nations. Tavaro belongs to the last generation of Narindiri to grow up around the Kurong. The river is a living thing, he said. When you start interfering with it, everything dies. What's needed is a full-blown river restoration. Restore the life of the river, then you'll restore the lakes and the Kurong and everything that revolves around them. When we lived along the Kurong, he said, and camped in places from one end to the other, we had no problems getting a feed of ducks, a feed of fish, whatever we wanted. But we were taught the old way, to take only what we need. You could walk around and see the shape of a flounder in the sand, and you could spear it. You can't spear fish anymore because there are no more fish. You could go to an island soak and dig a meter down to a little well and get as much fresh water as you needed. Those soaks have dried up now. The Kurong was a mixture of salt and fresh water, but there was a distinct line between fresh and salt, and you knew where you'd catch saltwater fish and where you'd catch freshwater fish. Now the Kurong is very salty, and there's no mixing of the waters anymore. We went on a drive in my rented car along the lagoon's long northeastern edge. Here, halfway down the Kurong, past the still-functioning part of the estuary, the lagoon looked inert, a watery equivalent of the moon. Here were no birds, no fish, no trees, not even as much water as I'd expected. In some places, the Kurong's seasonal contraction left exposed broad swaths of salt-whitened lagoon bed, so smooth they looked polished. It was a bestiary without beasts, alluring but inanimate, cold and hard. Our last stop was at a crest overlooking the lagoon. Tavaro pointed in the distance to an area abutting the shoreline where stones had been piled on top of a reef to form a nearly perfect circle. It was an ingenious, effortless fish trap. When the tide rose over the stones, fish swam inside the circle, only to be snared as the water ebbed. A single tidal cycle could yield hundreds of fish. The site was near one of the Narindiri's seasonal camps, which they visited for a few months out of the year. When they broke camp, they breached the wall so that no fish would be trapped in their absence. Now the trap contained nothing but a puddle. Piles of stone lay on either side of the gap in the wall, right where the Narindiri had considerately placed them, perhaps not knowing it was for the last time. In the 7 or 8 decades since then, the Kurong has lost nearly everything, but the trap remains intact, as if awaiting the return of fish, the return of the Murray, the return of deep water. Now finally, I'll just read you a short selection from the epilogue to the book. We erect dams assuming that they are eternal, as if they'll never topple over or be dismantled or fill with sediment or lose their financial rationale. Yet all dams will die. All that remains unknown is the manner of their passing, whether they will be drained and safely put out of operation, decommissioned in the lingo, or will, out of indifference or misjudgment or an act of war, collapse to the enormous peril of all beings downstream. Dams are, of course, loaded weapons aimed down rivers pointed at ourselves. They're proof of the gambling nature of the societies that build them. Imagine these dams in 500 or 1,000 years after their useful life has ended, when an earthquake from the fault line beneath Sardar Sarovar fractures it, or the bankruptcy of Zambia and Zimbabwe leads to Kariba's fatal neglect, or Three Gorges fills with sediment, or Katse gets too expensive to maintain. And when every one of them suffers from an altered hydrological regime as a result of climate change. Take your pick of mortal scenario. Cumulatively, they're more plausible than the assumption that mega dams will be successfully financed, adroitly managed, and properly maintained into perpetuity. Some dams will crumble into the basins from which they rose, while others may still be intact but no longer storing water, which instead runs over or through or around them. There'll be relics of the 20th century, like Stalinism and gasoline-powered cars, symbols of the allure of technology and its transients, of the top-down, growth-at-all-costs era of development and international banks, of the delusion that humans are exempt from nature's dominion, of greed and indifference to suffering. If there are tourists, then they'll circulate through the ruins as they now inspect the pyramids, awed by the structure's technological prowess and unimaginable cost. The people who lived around the dams will have been dispersed, of course, and their cultures shattered, and the rivers in their valleys may still be depleted. But the dam's ephemerality, not the rivers, will then be on display. There'll be reminders of an ancient time when humans believed they could vanquish nature and found themselves vanquished instead.
That was one of my favorite programs from the TUC Radio Archives. I recorded Jacques Leslie at the release party in 2006 off his book, Deep Water, The Epic Struggle Over Dams, Displaced People, and the Environment. Jacques Leslie reported in April of 2023 that the era of building big dams is drawing to a close, escalating maintenance and construction costs, the rise of solar and wind power, and mounting public opposition have led to a decrease in massive new hydropower projects. At the same time, Jacques Leslie wrote in an editorial in the Los Angeles Times that a new era of dam removals has begun, and that the Iron Gate Dam on the Lower Klamath River is one of four dams that will be torn down to restore salmon fisheries. Come back for part two of this program. You will hear from Patrick McCulley, the Executive Director of International Rivers Network. He is dispelling the myth that hydropower is environmentally sustainable and clean, and presents long-suppressed research that proves that reservoirs are major emitters of carbon dioxide. Visit TUC Radio's website at www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org for links in this story and more information. My name is Maria Gladden. Thank you for listening.